Good.
No telling.
So, let's see what it is that we want to talk about this morning. Anybody have anything on their mind? Any question?
You know,
don't be hesitant.
You've yes. talked about this extensively, but I can't remember the different, some schools talk, we were just talking about it Thursday. Some schools are talking about karma as the only causality, and according to the sutras, it seems to be, at least in some people's opinion, it seems to be more, or at least you're emphasizing attention.
So at least your intention, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but some people are pretty hardcore, like, no, there are no other types of causality. So could you just run through the other types of causality again?
Sure, yeah, very straightforward.
Could you repeat your question for the tape?
Okay, so the question is about the different views on karma. And there is a view on karma that predates the birth of the Buddha, but that some schools of Buddhism, even today, hold on to as being a literal truth. The view that absolutely everything is due to karma. And so the question is, what are the other kinds of causality? Because when Buddha was asked, and this is in a sutra, when he was asked by somebody who, by a Brahmin, and it was the Brahmins that held the view that absolutely everything was the result of karma. This Brahmin approached the Buddha and he asked him, he said, is it true that absolutely everything we experience, good or bad, comes to us as a result of karma? And the Buddha said, no, that's not true. Karma is only one kind of causality. Now, in that particular sutra, he takes an example, says, suppose you get sick, and he gives other examples of why you could become sick that had nothing to do with any past action of yours. In other places, the other kinds of causality are spelled out more explicitly. There have been five kinds of causality. One is physical causality, what we would regard as physics and chemistry. You know, matter and energy interact. And by the way, this is within the Buddhist teaching, you can find certain things that just really stand out as sort of absolute guidelines for understanding. One of those is that absolutely everything is causally determined. And related to that is the interdependence of things, that it's not a simple A causes B, because B is the result not only of A, but of many other factors as well, and ultimately everything is interconnected. Okay, so this first kind of causality is very familiar to all of us. Gravity, inertia, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, so on and so forth. Physics and chemistry. The second kind of causality is what we would call biological causality, life. And it is rooted in the first. And this is very familiar to us as well. Although if you think about it, as short a time ago as maybe 150, 200 years ago, people were still struggling to reconcile the difference between the non-living and the living worlds. But now we have no problem with that, neither did the Buddha, that biological causality arises out of material causality. And, you know, oak trees produce acorns, not strawberries, right? Things like that. Biology is a second level of causality that arises out of the first. And we look around the world, and yes, we see. We have a world that's shaped and formed as a result of biological causality. The third kind of causality is mental causality. And good morning.
Good morning.
And this is distinguished from karma, which is the next kind of causality, but just as biological causality arises out of physical causality, mental causality arises out of biological causality, and as we'll see when we get to it, karmic causality arises out of mental causality. But mental causality is beings, biological beings with minds, behave in particular ways because that's how their minds work. And that's a kind of causality. And we look around and we see all kinds of things happening as a result of mental causality. Mosquitoes sting you, and lizards eat flies, and you know, everywhere you look, minds work in particular ways, rooted in their biological nature, dependent upon their physical nature. But it produces a behavior that causes consequences in the world. All kinds of things happen. So that's the third level of causality. The fourth level of causality is karmic causality. And the Buddha took the word karma, which means action. And actually, there are two words that, you know, prior to the time of the Buddha, there are two words that can be translated as action. And karma is one of them. And karma was used to denote actions with moral consequences, actions of a moral nature, or an ethical nature. So killing was an action that was called karma. The other word, both of which means action, the other word, I can't remember it at the moment, things slip out of my mind too easily. Also means action, but they used that to mean sort of neutral actions that had no particular moral consequence. Like, you know, a glass of water spills, you know, or there's all kinds of actions without moral consequences. So when the Buddha used the word karma, and he said, when I say karma, and you can translate that as action with moral consequences. When I say karma, I mean intention. And he used a different word, cittana. So I mean intention. He said, all thoughts, all actions, all words are the result of intentions. And by saying, when I say karma, meaning moral action with moral consequences, I mean intention. He's saying, what has moral consequences ultimately are your intentions, not the actions themselves. So he was making a distinction right away at that point. Yes?
So what the Buddha is saying is that there is free will and that your intention is that choice point. Yeah. And also, once you make the choice, you imprint your mind stream, and the mind stream then affects the biology and the biochemistry. And so the chain, the interdependent chain of that intentional act goes all the way down to the material. And so I mean, they all sort of blend together in a way.
Well, let's see. There's several things. The Buddha would have addressed free will in a very, at the level of this discussion, we're just assuming that individuals have the ability to make choices, okay, which isn't in itself an affirmation that our ordinary understanding of free will is completely accurate, because the first question is, who has free will? And the answer is, there is no self. We won't get into that, okay. Right. The second thing is, what you're doing is you're looking for how intention causes consequences on the other levels of causality, the mental, the biological, and the physical level. Which it definitely does. Intention does. And all actions originate in intention. This is what the Buddha was saying. Now, when we examine, if we examine karma more closely, karma is referring to intention, and it is referring to a particular kind of consequence. And the Buddha redefined that as well. Okay? We can distinguish two kinds of consequences of a karmic action. I'm going to say karmic action. And here I mean is an action produced by a person as a result of intention. The action itself has consequences at the other three lower levels. So, if you kill somebody, that person suffers death and stays dead. That's a consequence. And we can attach a value judgment to that, and we can say, oh, that's an unwholesome action. Killing is an unwholesome action because look at the consequences it produces. If you are angry at the person when you kill them, the immediate result might be pleasure, but the longer-term result might be that you get imprisoned and executed. And those are consequences too. All of these kinds of consequences are called pala is the word, it means fruit. They are the fruits of the action. All actions have fruits. The fruits are the causal results that depend on mental factors. I mean, somebody decided to arrest you. Biological factors, things you do have biological consequences. I mean, you killed the person, now the person's dead. And material consequences. So all of that lower level of causality are the fruits. And there's nothing strange in that. That's something we're all familiar with. You do stuff, and stuff happens. And it's not even mysterious, the stuff that happens. Although the view of karma that was held prior to the Buddha would have said, absolutely everything that happens is the result of karma. And essentially denied the reality of these other kinds of causality. But the Buddha said, no, this is karmic.
I'm not following that link.
Okay, the idea that everything that happens to you. So
even the act of killing was forced upon you by karma.
That is one of the consequences of this thinking.
Okay.
But the way this thinking goes is that if somebody kills you, the reason they killed you is because of something you did in the past.
I understand.
If you get out of bed in the morning and you stub your toe, the reason you stubbed your toe was because of something you did in the past. If you eat lunch today and you get indigestion afterwards, the reason is because of something you did in the past.
Wait, clarify that. That's one of the schools. That's not what.
Well, I'm talking about here is the view of karma that everything is due to karma that was held prior to the Buddha.
Right. I understand.
And that is not really what the Buddha taught.
Okay.
Although, one of the things I could talk about is why he seems not to deny that in certain conversations with other people. But the view, that particular view, there is nothing that happens that's a result of anything else but karma. Whereas the Buddha said, no, there's all kinds of other causes for things. Now, what does the Buddha mean by the consequences of karma? A different word is vipaka, and what it means is that what is karmic is your intention behind the action, and the vipaka of that karma is the effect that it has on you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. All right, that's what we're getting
at.
Right. Now, the effect that it has on you in terms of your mind and what kind of a person that you are. Okay? And so now, if your intentions can be of a nature that either lead you closer to wisdom, insight, and awakening, and reduce the grip of the afflictions of craving and self-attachment and so forth. Okay, any particular intention can either move you in the positive direction or it can move you in the negative direction, reinforcing your attachment to self, reinforcing craving, and leading you further from wisdom, awakening, and enlightenment. Okay? So that's how the Buddha is using karma. It's the effect that it has on you. And so a karmically good intention, regardless of the action, a karmically good intention is one that molds and shapes your mind in such a way that you are at least a little bit more one way or the other. A karmically neutral intention is one that doesn't change you from where you are. Okay? Now, if we examine the consequences of intentions and actions, because they're happening together, we actually find that you can have good intentions that involve actions which by themselves might appear not to be so good. And you could have bad intentions that give rise to actions that appear from the outside to be good, that we would say, oh, well, giving that person that gift, that's a good thing. You know? But if your intention behind it was some kind of selfish gain, it's reinforced your own attachment to self and your future pleasure and stuff like that. So it's actually, at the karmic level, it's moved you in the negative direction, even though the action itself may have positive consequences. Other people may respect you more and like you better and see you as a generous person. But inside, you've been diminished. So there's this kind of difference. A doctor can do something that causes the patient pain, but is ultimately beneficial towards them. Okay? And so the intention is to help the person. The outcome is positive and the intention is positive, so they're both in line with each other. Even though, if you look at them from a more narrow focus, it seems like, oh, what he's doing is hurting that person, right? We can even conceive of situations where somebody might commit an act that appears to be a bad act. You know, killing, for example. Somebody might, but yet, we can imagine a situation where a person, a bodhisattva even, might perform an act like killing that in and of itself appears to be a bad act and produces a negative consequence on a person that they're doing it. But it's actually done out of a good intention. So the pala, the fruits, can be of a bad sort, but the vipaka can actually be of a positive sort. So you see that the two start to, they can diverge. They often go together. You see, take practicing generosity, for example. You can practice generosity because you believe everything's due to karma and the generosity you practice is going to cause good things to come to you. It's like the secret, practicing the secret. You know, the secret, be generous and then you'll find checks showing up in the mail. Okay, I'm going to be generous so that I get rich and happy and have all the things that I want. You practice generosity in that way. You're making bad karma for yourself, even though you're doing good acts in the world, because your motivation is impure. Your motivation is reinforcing your own attachment. It's reinforcing your own deluded beliefs about the way things work. It's moving you further from enlightenment. Now, you could be a little wiser than that, and you could perform an act of generosity because it's a good act. Right? This is a good act, and I want to be a virtuous person, so I'm going to perform this act because it's inherently good, the person I'm giving to is going to benefit, and it'll be good for me, and it will be good for you. It'll be good for you in a variety of ways. If you practice generosity, good things happen to you. It's inevitable. As a part of the other levels of causality, that to some degree or another, you know, sometimes generous people have bad things happen to them. Yes. But in general, generous people are better liked, more respected, and are more likely to be the beneficiaries of other people's generosity. You know, so there is that element of truth, but that's not the karmic part of it. And the example we're talking about, the karmic part of it, is the person is giving not out of a selfish motivation, but for the benefit of the other person, and because they see this as an inherently good act. And so that has an internal effect. That will make them to be a person who is by nature a little bit more generous and more likely to be generous in the future. They will be by nature less attached to things, and it will reduce their potential for suffering because they're less attached to things. And it will have other consequences in terms of their mind, so that the different things that happen to them, they will respond to them with less attachment, less suffering, more equanimity, and more happiness. Now, there is still yet another level at which you can practice generosity, which is the recognition that all of my suffering that I experience in my life is due to my own desires, my own aversions, my own craving, and those in turn are all the result of my attachment to myself. Therefore, I'm going to practice generosity as a way of intentionally overcoming my attachment to this deluded perception that I've been carrying since I was born, in the hopes that I will become less subject to the compulsions of craving and aversion and so forth. If you do that, then your intention has the most powerful karmic effect, because you are very deliberately, from a place of wisdom, cultivating in yourself a change in yourself to move you towards enlightenment. And the more karmic acts of that kind you perform. So you are not doing it out of a selfish motivation. You're not doing it even just because it's good for somebody else. You're doing it for a motivation that is described as neutral in terms of our ordinary perception of good and bad. But it's actually, this neutral motivation is the highest. It is to, you're intentionally transforming yourself to become a being of enlightenment. See? So this is the Buddhist version of karma. It coincides with the other version of karma in the sense that, in general, people who do good things do fare better in the world, right? And that's a good thing. But it has this deeper meaning, which is that you, through your intentions, make shape the kind of being you are. You can become free from suffering, not because bad things won't happen to you. Somebody might still rob you, you know, and a piece of a satellite might come down out of the sky and bang you on the head. And that's not the result of your karma. What is the result of your karma is how much you suffer or don't suffer when those things happen. So this is a radically different perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's totally consistent with everything else that about the Buddha's teaching. He set out to find an end to suffering. He tried a lot of stuff. He even tried to force the mind. So he practiced austerities for 5 years of an extreme form. And the purpose of those is to see if you can make the mind impervious to pain. And he learned from that. What he learned is that pain is pain, and it's always going to be there. Suffering is what the mind does with pain. And he figured out where the suffering comes from. Suffering comes from wanting things to be different than they are, and generating desire and aversion and pursuing those. And this, you know, this in turn comes from the deluded belief in a separate self. And so this all fits together in a very, very cohesive and very comprehensive view and practice. But karma is intention that changes the kind of person you are, that changes you into the kind of person who, no matter what happens to you, does not need to suffer. And an awakened person who has completely overcome the attachment to self, the belief in a separate self, and the compulsions to act out of desire and aversion, is not going to suffer no matter what happens to them. So, in the sense that karma, the outcome of karma is that you either suffer or you don't suffer, exactly the same language applies to the Buddha's version of suffering, of karma. Because the outcome of karma, in this sense intention, is that you are or are not going to suffer. Not because we somehow manipulated the world so that the world's going to treat us differently. Because you see, that's one of the false views that we all hold that we start out with, is that things make me happy, things make me unhappy, I've got to manipulate things if I want to be happy. That's one of the views that anything we do that reinforces that view is moving us away from awakening. And is going to guarantee that we're going to experience more suffering, not less. Right? And so there's this underlying problem in that view, which is the belief that I am a separate self, there is an external world, and all my happiness and unhappiness is due to the interaction between these two separate, distinct things.
I was taught once that if you get struck by lightning, that's karma, because it was your karma to be there.
Well, at the level of the first three levels of causality, it can be your karmic intentions that put you in that place. I mean, you could have had a lot of intentions over a course of a period of time that built up a really big ego structure that needed to be supported in every way. And so when somebody said to you, well, you wouldn't dare go stand next to that tree in this lightning storm, and you said, I sure as hell will. Boom. Okay. That is a pala. That is a material level consequence of how you conditioned your mind.
When there's lightning up here and I think I can walk around, nobody's going to hit me by lightning.
I've heard people say that if it's not your karma, you can walk down the freeway and nobody will hit you.
The other way I've heard it is a plane goes down, everybody's killed, and everybody had, that was their karma.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you see, this other view, if you say that the only causality is karma, then you're positing some mysterious source of or force or power or something. I mean, it's a very godlike thing.
Kind of like God, yes.
With total omnipotence, that it can manipulate everything that's happening in the world to make it come out just right.
Like it's an organizing principle behind everything.
Yeah. And, boy, what a job that entity has.
Right.
Because it's got to make sure that all 250 people on the airplane, that get on that airplane, have the karma for it to crash. And if one person gets on who doesn't have the karma to die in a plane crash, well, by gosh, they're going to change it all.
Right.
Well, as you can see, it gets ludicrous trying to imagine how this could be. But, of course, the people who want to believe in it have worked very hard to find solutions. And that's the amazing thing about our mind. Our mind can cook up an explanation for absolutely anything. So, when you figure out that it's just this is getting just totally ridiculous trying to imagine how everything could be coordinated so that everything happens as a result of past karma. And they said, well, let's just get rid of the everything. Let's say it all happens in the mind. And it was easy for them to do this because one of the things that was realized is that we only know the world the way our mind sees it. And so we don't really know what's on the other side of the what's on the other side of our sense organs. All we know is the information that comes into the mind from the sense organs and the interpretation the mind puts on it. And so when that recognition was clear and being communicated, it got to the people that wanted everything to be due to karma. They said, okay, well, when I'm asleep, I see things and I hear things and I know there's nothing there. So therefore, maybe there's never anything there. It's all in my mind all the time. Anyway, nothing exists except my own mind. Now this is a way that you could, it solve all this karma is the cause of everything problem, right? Because if it's only happening in my mind, it's like a dream. Anything can happen. And so if some part of my mind wants to punish me for something I did in the past, it can make some bad thing happen to me in the dream of this moment. So that was a really neat solution. But then it leads to another problem. Part of my dream is all of these other people. So you end up, well, you either go back to the same original problem or else none of these other people are real. And I'm the only one that exists. So it leads into all kinds of problems. The view that karma is everything leads to problems that lead to desperate attempts to resolve those problems that lead to even worse problems. One of those, and this is the original part of it, because people saw that good people, bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. And this put the entire concept of everything's karma immediately at total risk. So the first solution that was invented is, oh, well, you see, the good people have bad things happen to them, it's because of what they did in past life, and so forth. And those people that are doing good things, even though bad things are happening to them in this life, when they get reborn, then good things will happen to them. Nice, neat little solution, right? Although there's a problem with this. It means that you are being punished for things that you didn't know you did. You have no idea what you're being punished for. And so what started out to be an attempt to find that we live in a just and fair universe. This is what karma wants to do. This is what the people that invented it wanted to do. They wanted the universe to be a just and fair place. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look like it is. But if we have this law of karma, and if it can extend over multiple lives, then the universe can still be a just and fair place. But where is the justice? And where is the fairness when you don't know what you're being punished for? You can't even learn from it. Instead of being just retribution when something bad happens to you, it's just plain old revenge from an avenger that you don't even know.
Yeah? Does it seem strange that a lot of, I think, contemporary Buddhist teachers really emphasize what sounds like the old version of karma?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think they're doing that?
Well,
wait, I want to just ask that, and then another question that's totally different. Not really a question, but so, like, okay, so just set that one aside for a second. So, if the tree falls in the forest, you know, does it make a sound? So, like, I would say, yeah, it makes a sound, but I get that I'm walking around in a world that I can only experience through my own perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So, the question then seems totally irrelevant because I can't hear it unless I'm in the forest.
That is part of the truth. Each of us, our conscious experience is the only thing we know. Anything else is totally inference. And the inference can be as easily false as true. But we rely on inference. I mean, you parked your car out there and you expect it's going to still be there when you go back, right? You know, and if you went in the woods one day and the tree's standing up and you went the next day and it's fallen down, you're going to assume it's laying on the ground. You're going to assume that somewhere in between the tree fell down. But all you know is tree standing and tree falling. You just infer that that happened in between. But part of that conundrum, you know, when a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? What is a sound? And the fact is, a tree doesn't make a sound. It takes a mind to make a sound. It takes ears and a mind before there's any sound. Something happens, yes. And based, once again, by inference, using inference the way that we do, we have deduced that what causes ears and minds to make sounds is vibrations of something we call air, which has a property of elasticity, etc., and we could go on into an elaborate physical explanation, right? And that's all inference. And how close it is to the truth of what's on the other side of our sense organs, we have no way of knowing. Okay? But that's that same epistemological truth that led people to say that, well, everything is only in the mind. And as a matter of fact, just to see where that one takes us, the epistemological truth that all we can ever know is our own mental experience, and we can never know how close or how far it is from what's on the other side of our senses. If we take that truth and we examine it more deeply and compare ourselves to other kinds of organisms, we can come to a pretty solid conclusion that absolutely nothing my human mind can come up with is going to really be particularly close to whatever ultimate reality is. Okay? And so that's described by saying that everything we experience is empty. That's emptiness. Emptiness is the fact that all we'll ever know is what happens in here. We can't really know what's out there. That means that trees don't exist, standing or falling.
Ultimately.
Ultimately, there are no trees. There are no things. All of the things that our mind creates are just what our mind creates. So then, you can make the step from that and say, well, that means that if nothing exists, well, ultimate reality doesn't exist either. And that's ridiculous. Every illusion has a basis in something that is of a different nature. And so that's another one of those mistaken views. It's not so much mistaken as a subtle misunderstanding. When you realize that everything is empty of being the way it appears to us to be, that is also true of any conception of ultimate reality we have. Any conception of ultimate reality is just as empty as any other conception we have, including trees and ghosts and anything else. So it's true. Where it goes off is when it slips into nihilism that says there is nothing. Because that's unwarranted. There's no basis for that. There's no basis to say that nothing exists. It's just that nothing that we know exists, including our perceptions of what we think ultimate reality might be. So, yeah.
Can we get back to karma just for 1 second? Because I'm trying to understand a point that you're making about past lives and bad things that happen to us in this lifetime are a result of actions in a past lifetime. If there's no...
You're not making that point, though, are you?
The way...
No, that's not the point I'm making.
That's not the point you're making? Okay, because so
no.
The way I sort of see this biological organism is that on the level of intention, which sort of comes from the universal aspiration, I want to be happy, I don't want to suffer,
mm-hmm.
that universal intention sort of moves me around, which means that's the intention that can have or not have moral consequences, but it's sort of the operating principle that wants me to itch my scalp or take a drink or cause somebody some harm.
Mm-hmm.
The accumulation of all of those actions then is all just recorded by this organism. So that karma goes down to mind, goes down to then the biology, and I'm not sure when we talk about biology materially, I don't see how it changes physics at all. But I know that through neuroplasticity, we change our own minds and our biochemistry, and we can either fulfill in this lifetime a potential for more wellness or more illness based on what we do right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in this lifetime, I completely understand that sort of karma.
Mm-hmm.
But if we do talk about multiple lifetimes and we take away the fact that this karma is our possession, then the universe does seem a little bit more chaotic in the sense that I have a precious human life right now, but doesn't matter what I do or how close to enlightenment I get, I could be born as a frog in my next lifetime, and that seems like that unfair universe that you were just that some karmic theorists want to solve.
Yes, the idea that the problem with this thinking is as soon as you have some linkage between the individual that you are right now and some individual that lived in the past in a completely different body,
mm-hmm.
and some individual that may live in the future in a completely different body,
mm-hmm.
God or frog, doesn't matter the difference.
Okay.
Where is that linkage? That is the and within Buddhism, those who want to sustain that belief,
mm-hmm.
you see, if you try to hold on to the pre-Buddha view of karma,
uh-huh.
you have to also hold on to the pre-Buddha view of reincarnation.
Uh-huh.
And it just keeps opening up more and more problems in that way. And Buddhists, amongst the Buddhist religions and traditions in the world, they've gone to enormous lengths to try to come up with something that can link the being that you are now with some being in the past and the future.
And that's sort of where that lineage where I come from, that's all we were ever taught, the bardos and how you dissolve into and you go through these stages and how you reemerge and they have it all mapped out.
But the most basic thing that the Buddha taught over and over again is there is no separate self. And when asked about, what's going to happen to me after I die? The Buddha said, it's a waste of time to think about that because it's the wrong question. He said there are two wrong views. One is the view that I, the self who I am,
uh-huh.
is going to be annihilated
uh-huh.
when I die. Uh-huh. And the other is the self that I am is going to, by some mysterious process we can't identify,
uh-huh.
be reborn as another person or a frog or a god. He said, both of those are wrong. And he said, the reason that they're wrong is that there is no self now. There's no self to be annihilated, and there's no self to be reincarnated.
So then, therefore, that makes me think that there's just sort of this one consciousness that multiplies itself. And it seems like the consciousness that's conscious is looking out of those eyes and these eyes and those eyes.
Yeah. Now you're getting on to something really good here.
Okay. That's always where I've been, except then I did the sort of Tibetan thing, and it was just like, and I would argue in debate class about how mind-only school is the wrong view, and I'm thinking to myself, well, if I understand the science well enough, the science more points to a sort of a mind-only school, which is this happy sort of revelation to hear you say that, because I've always been sort of struggling with the making sense of the constant stream, and that we are separate streams somehow after a death.
Yeah.
That where, what keeps it separate? I just didn't understand that.
Well, see, that's one of the things. When I said that Buddhist intellectuals have gone to great length to rationalize the unrationalizable, this is one of the ways that they have, which is the stream of consciousness.
Yes.
And the most astounding thing for somebody, I love telling this to somebody that's been totally immersed in studying the stream of consciousness philosophy, is the Buddha in a sutra a fisherman's son named Sati, who was one of his disciples and who was a very brilliant man, thought he had it all figured out, and he was teaching the stream of consciousness theory. And the Buddha heard about it, and the Buddha just tore him to pieces. But that hasn't kept these other schools from writing massive commentaries about the stream of consciousness theory. But there's an interesting thing. If you look at the Tibetan teachings, what you'll find is that they only study the commentaries. They never study the sutras. And if you ask them why, they'll tell you. They'll say that in the sutras, the Buddha was teaching to many of different people of many different levels of understanding, and so he said contradictory things. And until you're wise enough, it'll only confuse you to read the sutras. So better you read the commentary. You read our version of it, because if you go back to those sutras, you're not going to believe us anymore.
Yeah. Okay. This is good.
And that is, you know, it is really true that the Buddha taught people of many different levels of understanding and many beliefs. And if he was trying to make one point, and somebody believed something that was firmly believed something that didn't necessarily have to do the point the Buddha was making, he would speak as though that belief was true. And so that easily gets interpreted as meaning that, oh, well, I believe the Buddha taught that this was true. When somebody was suffering grief because somebody had died, and they went to the Buddha and said, I know you have I know you're omniscient, so can you please tell me what's happened to my beloved son, wife, husband, whatever it was? You know, where are they going to be reborn? And the Buddha would say, don't worry, they're going to be reborn and blah, 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 and it's going to be all right. I mean, what's he going to do? He's going to say, no, in the midst of your grief, let's sit down and I'm going to try to explain to you how the selfhood of this precious person that you're grieving for was on illusion all the time? I don't think so. He's going to give them an answer. And very often, what he does in the answer that he gives them is he gives them some guidance as to how they may live better, they may become wiser, they may move themselves closer to being enlightened in some other way, even though they're still stuck on this point that they believe in.
Wow, this is a big topic.
It is a big topic.
There's a book that found its way, I don't know, karmically to me. It's called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation.
20 which?
20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation.
Oh, that's fine.
So I've been reading this, and there are many stories of people who system in a village who died, who were later born again, who had no, absolutely no contact with the prior family or the prior village, who knew and started speaking from a very young age, 3, 4 years, about previous mother, previous father, family, and then they would take them there, and this child would know everybody, mm-hmm. which argues for the stream of consciousness.
It only argues for the stream of consciousness if you believe in reincarnation. Now tell me, is reincarnation the only possible explanation for somebody genuinely knowing events in the lives of another person?
No.
Is that the only possible explanation?
What would the other ones be then?
Wouldn't it be that consciousness exists and that you could tap into it?
Oh, you just sort of have some sort of like a radio station. You sort of dial in mind over here, mind over here, and think because it's the cultural belief that. Oh.
Yeah, you interpret it as reincarnation, but what it is it's very strong evidence that we're all interconnected and that we are not the separate selves we think we are.
Okay, and so I work at a place, and I'm sorry if I'm talking too much, please, because I want to be really cognizant. I work at a place where people from all over the world come and pay a lot of money to talk to a person who will tell them about what's going to happen to them, what has happened to them, that people are there and speaking to them, and all kinds of things that I completely don't understand, but I am there witnessing all of this happening, and it's hard for me to sort that out. Like, is that possible to tap into that information in the field? I guess maybe, I don't know. What's the
end? Well, have you ever had a dream, or it could be a waking experience.
Uh-huh.
But have you ever had a dream that was so incredibly vivid and detailed, and as a part of being in that dream, the history of the dreamer in this dream situation was a part of the dream as well. And it was so detailed and elaborate and totally different than anything you've ever experienced,
mm-hmm.
but it's a total mystery.
Yes.
How your mind could
yes.
come up with.
I've had that where in a dream I was thinking thoughts that I could never possibly think.
Yes.
They were so beyond me, like Shakespeare in my head.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I woke up like, oh my God, what in the world just was that? That was not. Okay, so
and
yes.
Sometimes you wake up from that dream and it can literally take 5 minutes before you're sure which reality is genuine.
Yes.
And sometimes these things happen when you're awake, I swear. Now, if you believe in reincarnation, your first thing is, oh, wow, I've had a memory of a previous life.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I've had those experiences and I've had those dreams and I've also done the practices for recollection of previous life. Mm-hmm. And the erroneous idea is that there's a sequence of lives like a string of beads.
Okay.
The stream of consciousness,
okay.
The single separate stream of consciousness.
Okay.
That's the fallacy.
Okay.
The fact that there is no separate self. We are all interconnected. That at the level of mind, the universe is just as completely interconnected as we know that it is at the level of matter.
As above, so below.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. As with mind,
homogeneous
so
isotropic
matter.
Yes.
So these things, when somebody has the experience of recollecting past lives, that's completely true as long as by past lives they don't mean, well, it's this one particular self. Because even when you have those experiences, you examine them, you know the person that you are now is absolutely not the person that you were tapping into.
Yes.
So the ramifications of this in terms of karma if you do terrible things, if you are exploitive, and as a result of your exploitiveness, there are people living in poverty and slums and so forth. If you do that in this life, you, in the true sense of you, are definitely going to experience the consequences of your actions, because people are going to be born into those slums and into that poverty. And you are as much those people as anyone else. So in essence, all of them are your future lives.
Simultaneously. I see.
Right.
That makes sense.
So you can... What's really interesting is that if you understand how karma really works, you can take the naive view of karma and you can realize that to a large degree you can describe what karma really is using words that sound the same as the naive view of karma. I could say to you, knowing how I understand the meaning of these words, if you do that action, you're going to suffer the consequences of it in a future life. And I mean that totally, but I don't mean that there is some series of Mark Pertles that the next one born along the line is going to reap the results.
A living being.
That's right.
Consciousness will.
The interesting thing is all of this, it keeps coming back to the same thing. The Buddha realized that the Atman is an illusion. Once you realize the Atman is illusion, then everything starts to fall into place. You see that it all starts to come together. And it makes sense. It's comprehensible. And it is far more satisfying, the understanding it gives you is far more satisfying than trying to believe in reincarnation and trying to believe in some mysterious kind of karma that makes everything happen in a particular way and all of these other things. Far more satisfying and useful, because it allows you to look at the world in a way, think in a way, generate the kind of intentions and act in a way that is going to move you towards enlightenment, towards wisdom. You will act with much more compassion, and you will become free from suffering as a result. The Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering, and you got to get over the illusion that you're a self to do that. Sums it up.
This seems like a perfect topic for an article for Tricycle.
It would be, yes. Want to help me with it? You're a writer. Okay, we'll do it. You're on. So, but we kind of, I don't know that we really got where you wanted to go, Shelley, when you were asking some more.
She asked, how is it that this came to be, that all these contemporary teachers are teaching this? And I'd say, that's a big
topic. I'm thinking mostly of
historically.
Well, yes, but it's not just the Tibetans. You find it in many places. But the interesting thing is, within the Tibetans, you'll find tiny subsets that you hardly ever hear about that know that this is all bunkum. And the same thing, as the Buddha said, after his own enlightenment, he said, this is tough stuff. Nobody's going to understand. And he didn't see any point trying to teach it. But he went ahead and did, and he was able to teach it, and many people did understand. But many people didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. And so, almost from the get-go, the teachings became contaminated with false views. And as the Dharma has spread and developed, there's been this constant tension between the true teaching of the Buddha and the false views that are basically, when somebody can't quite wrap their mind about something, which is not so much a limitation of their mind as the fact that that they're too, that there's certain ideas that they are afraid to give up and don't want to give up. The main one being the attachment to self. There are so many Buddhists, there's so many people that come to Buddhism, they learn the Buddha taught no self, and the first thing they do is immediately go to work interpreting how, well, when the Buddha said that the five aggregates are not self, he wasn't saying there's no self, he just meant the self was something else and not them. I mean, this happens all of the time, and it's happened for 2,500 years. And that's why we have the teachings that we do. And that's why it's so confusing, is because of the tension between these two. The Dalai Lama is in a terrible situation in a certain sense. He knows the truth, but he's responsible for upholding a religious belief. And so he has to be so careful. Everything that he says, he has to put it in terms that are sufficiently ambiguous that those who want to believe what they've always believed can still believe that. And that's what he does. It's every now and then, in things that aren't meant to be so public and aren't meant to be such doctrinally correct teachings, he leaks things out. And there is a history of Tibet that he collaborated in, and a lot of that he talks about his life and the previous Dalai Lamas. And you read that, and this is not something, this was supposed to be history, and so I think he felt a little more free to say things. When you read that, it's really clear that he doesn't identify with these previous Dalai Lamas himself. Some of them were so different from him that he can't even understand them. And he says that. On the other hand, what, at the level of mind, just as at the level of matter, everything's interconnected. What your mind does has impacts that go right to the edges of the universe and continue to the end of time. And of course, the closer in space and in time we look to the trajectory of your individual five aggregates and your seemingly separate mind, the closer the connection we can see between those impacts. So I think a way to understand the Tulku reincarnation system of Tibet is that there will be baby Tibetans born whose minds are sufficiently attuned to what's necessary to provide spiritual leadership, that if they can be identified early enough and trained from day one, they can be formed to so that they fulfill that role. And there's a consistency, not because the same person is somehow reincarnated, but rather that we rely on the wisest Tibetan sages around to try to figure out and guesswork and ritual ceremonies and consulting oracles to somehow lead us to a baby who's a suitable vessel. And if that baby is a sufficiently suitable vessel, we can recreate the person we need to replace the one that's gone. And it works, and it makes sense. And it's fine if you let people that don't understand what's really going on think it's the same person being reincarnated. The problem is, every now and then, they'll pick the wrong baby. Mm-hmm. And the teaching just won't take.
So what do they do then if they've picked the wrong baby and here this child is being groomed into this role?
Well, if you look at the history of Tibet, two things. If it's in somebody's political interest to to keep that person there, then everybody just waits for them to die. And if that's not the case, then they're often killed so they can start looking for a new one right away.
But then, so well, if one is going to have a reign for a certain period of time, then during that time, then the population just doesn't make spiritual advancement. They just, it's like, just flat, kind of, flatlined for a
yeah.
while.
Like this is true.
Maybe even brought down.
Some of the Dalai Lamas. There's been Dalai Lamas who, as soon as they were old enough to, they would sneak out of the Potala and visit the prostitutes and drink and party and things like that. But they have regents, and a regent basically has all the power of the Dalai Lama. So the regents just take over and just keep doing things. And in the case of the particular Dalai Lama that I'm thinking of, it's a fifth or sixth, I don't remember, I'm not good at that part, but in this particular one, he wasn't interested in being the spiritual leader of Tibet. He was interested in partying. And so as long as the regent got to keep being the regent and didn't have to be replaced, then they worked out a workable deal that this Dalai Lama would carouse and party all he wanted. And he'd let the regents and the other senior lamas and everybody else run the affair. So it worked out really well. Everybody was happy. And then when he died, they found another one who worked out much better.
And the people didn't think it was just a little odd that he was out browsing and partying for Dalai Lama?
Well, it's hard to know, but I suspect that they went to great lengths to keep too many people from finding out. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's one of the rules, is when you're going to go do this, don't wear your robes. Don't tell anybody your real name.
It's impressions, past impressions from the subconscious mind that are formed in these elaborate dreams. You know, for the last few years, I've been so getting that it's not that. From my own experiences and like wild, elaborate dreams that I couldn't possibly have conjured up with my subconscious mind. It's just not there. It's another life. It's someone else's world that I walk into, and it's not from the past, so I know it can't be past life because it's now.
Yeah.
It's in the contemporary world, and there's these elaborate scenes that like could be like a ballroom party, or it could be usually they're spiritual dreams, but I've had, you know, circles of people I'm surrounded by, don't know one of them, but you know, I'm in it as if I'm there, and it's like just amazing. And I so thought that that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just got it, you know. I mean, not just now, but I've just been getting it. And I'll tell Robin that, you know, like, I just know that these dreams I'm tapping into, you know, through, I don't know what Akka codes are exactly or whatever that is, but, you know, somehow or other there is consciousness is going into other, tapping into other realms of reality in today's world. And probably others too, you know, so multidimensional. So, thank you for that, because that like such a confirmation.
Well, you're welcome. That confirmation, I'm really happy to give it to you. And you can continue to develop that. It's called the siddhi, a power. You know? And the siddhis are the knowing the minds of others, which is actually what you're doing in all of these experiences. All of the siddhis are knowing the minds of others. But knowing the minds of others, recollecting past lives is also knowing the minds of others. The divine eye, which is seeing through the eyes of others. The divine ear, which is hearing with the ears of others. All of the siddhis are the same thing. They're this, your mind begins to open up and be porous, and you tap into the larger consciousness and the larger mental reality. And it's wonderful. I'm happy for you that you're having that experience, and even more happy that I can have a chance to tell you what it is.
Yeah, I really appreciate the confirmation of that realization, because it's like a knowing much deeper than what the world says things are or how they are, you know, like about in reference to Jesus.
Have you had the experience of talking to somebody and interacting with somebody, and it's like you just have this sense of what they're feeling, what they're thinking?
Mm-hmm.
That's the same thing. Yeah, that's the same thing. Mm-hmm.
Maybe the work's working.
Well, this has been a fun and exciting discussion.
Amazing.
Probably opened up some new grounds for some of you. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and sit.